calculus. I just need to introduce the terminology. So I'm going to quickly introduce the calculus and then the terminology, and then we'll take a break, and then the special relativity, and at the end we'll combine metrics and special relativity and see how we use that to move on to general relativity. I should wait for another minute. Well, they all know this stuff anyway, so.
It's just calculus.
Okay. Stuff we learned in calculus. In this talk, little t, or sometimes capital T, is always going to represent time. Parameterized curves, you know about them. Sigma of t is x of t, y. I'm in the plane, R2 here. For instance, this nice parameterized curve for that interval of time. When t is 1, I'm at 2, 1, which gets me down here. When t is 2, I'm at 8, 8, up here. In between, the point moves along that nice curve. That's our parameterized curve. And we think of it as being a moving point, the path of a moving point. We know about the velocity vector. You learned about that. Sigma prime is x prime, comma y prime, where the primes mean derivatives with respect to time, of course. And there's a picture. You've seen that kind of picture in your calculus class. And the length of that velocity vector is the speed. There it is. And most importantly, or almost most importantly for us, to find the arc length, the length of the curve, you integrate speed. That's what speed is. That's what distance is, the integral of speed. So I integrate the speed from the initial time to the end time, and I get the length of that curve. And I'm going to use this traditional tau to denote that arc length. So you learn all that in calculus. Here's just a new word coming up here. We saw for this parameterized curve, this formula gives the arc length. So if I differentiate both sides, the derivative of arc length, that tells me how fast is the arc length changing. And it's given, of course, by the integrand, which is the speed. No surprises there. Squaring both sides, I get this, which leaving out the t, I can write as shorthand that way. And then I'm going to switch to the other notation for derivatives, the dx dt notation, and this equation becomes this. And I'm going to write a shorthand for this equation just by multiplying through a formal multiplication, multiplying through by the dt squared, and I get this. And that form is called the metric for r squared. You can think of it various ways. Oops, pieces here, but well, you can hold off which one you use. Think of it exercising blue power. So, R2, there's the metric, and various ways to think about it. We're going to be thinking about it as a reminder that the rate of change of arc length is given by that little formula. Of course, in R3, free space, that becomes our metric. Now I'm going to consider a plane embedded in free space. The plane z equals 3x plus 2y. So if I'm over here, and here's my x-axis and my y-axis, and I'll put a chair out of your way. X-axis, y-axis, z-axis. The plane z equals 3x plus 2y is the plane that passes through the origin. In the x direction, it's got a slope of 3, and in the y direction, it's got a slope of 2. It is that plane, embedded in 3 space. But it's flat, embedded in 3 space. Suppose I got a curve, a parameterized curve, sitting in this plane. So picture that plane there, and picture a curve in it. What would it look like? Well, you'd have an x of t, a y of t, and a z of t. But the z of t would have to satisfy that. The z of t would have to be 3 times the x plus 2 times the y. That puts it in our inclined plane. Find the derivative, find the velocity vector. There it is. I simply use the rules for differentiation. And so the length of that vector, I take the length of that vector, and I integrate it. So there's the length, is the x prime squared plus the y prime squared plus the z prime. There's the z prime squared. This simplifies to that. So of course, taking derivatives, the tau prime is given by this integrand, which is that square root. So the metric for that plane is this thing, because that gives me the pattern inside that square root, except that the primes, x prime is replaced by dx, and so on. Okay? So again, I'm thinking of this metric as telling me that this, if I had a curve in that inclined plane, this is how fast its arc length would change. Okay? Let's find that metric another way. There's my plane again. So I'm going to be with the metric for the whole R3. There it is. But then I remember to use that. So I use the derivative rules, except I do it in metric notation. Instead of writing z prime equals 3x prime plus 3y, 2y prime, I write this. And then I have that, but that dz squared becomes this thing squared. And I simplify, I get that just like before. So that's the second way of finding the metric. And again, I remind you, it's simply a way of remembering that if we have a parameterized curve in our plane, the rate of change of its arc length is given by that nice little formula. So what this is telling me is, if I know how fast the x is changing and how fast the y is changing, I can figure out how fast the arc length is changing. Okay, that's all that's telling me. Now, here's something that took me a while to figure out, because I'm not all that smart, but I finally realized this point, x of t, y of t, is a label for this point. This is the actual point in the actual plane we're talking about, but this is a label for it. And this information is telling me how fast the label is changing. So what we have here says, if you know how fast the label is changing, then you know how fast the actual point is moving. Now, that doesn't seem very profound, but later on, at the very end, we're going to be in four-dimensional space-time, x, y, z, t, and it's going to be bent. And there's no way we can actually picture something moving through that bent four-dimensional thing. So we have to learn to trust that knowledge about the labels gives us accurate information about the actual point, which we cannot picture. So I mentioned that here. It took me a while to figure that out, that this is an important idea. There's the label and the point, don't confuse them, but there is a connection. And the metric reminds us of the connection. Let's look at something curved. The surface z equals x times y. So at the point xy, at the point x is 2, y is 3, I take 2 squared times 3, I go up, this is 12, I put a dot. And I do that for every point on the plane. I go up or down if it's negative, and I get a bunch of all those dots that they form the surface. Let me convince you that it's curved. Look at it along the line y equals x. At 0, 0, I go up to 0. At 1, 1, I go up to 1. At 2, 2, I go up to 4. At 3, 3, I go up to 9. At minus 1, minus 1, I go up to 1. I'm getting a parabola on my surface above the line. This is the labels. The labels are on that line. The actual points are on that parabola. So that should convince you we got this curved surface. Okay? Let's find its metric. Well, I begin with this because it's part of free space, but I have that. So I use the rules for differentiation, the product rule, in metric notation. And I square this. I start with my metric for R3, and I replace that dz squared with this thing squared, and I simplify. So there is my metric for this curved surface. And again, that's a reminder that if I've got a curve like this one, a parameterized curve like this one, notice I've got an x and a y and a z, the z being x times y, telling me it really is sitting on that curvy sheet that we have. This is the formula. This formula coming from that pattern tells me how fast the arc length is changing. Let's compare the flat one to the curvy one, the flat metric. There it is. Oh, look, constant, constant, constant. An expert would glance at this and say, oh, we got a flat plane embedded in three space. An expert would look at this and say, oh, boy, this is more interesting. This is something curvy. One thing that's going on is here, all you need to know is how, think of that dx as how fast the x is changing, the dy is how fast the y is changing. If you know those two bits of information, you find out how fast, you can find out how fast the arc length is changing. But here you need to know more. Not only how fast are the x and y changing, but what are the x and y? Because you also need to know the value for y and the value for x. So a given change in x and y will produce different results depending on where you are taking that change. Okay? So I'm just trying to give you a quick introductory feel for metrics and how you can use them, because we're going to need them a little bit at the end. Okay, there's the metric for R2. Let's go into polar coordinates. There they are. X equals R cosine theta, Y is R sine theta. And of course, everything in sight is a function of time. You're all changing with time. I apply the rules of differentiation of that in metric form, and I get that. I apply the product rule and the chain rule, and the derivative of cosine is minus sine, okay? And then I square this to get this big mess, and I do similarly with the dy squared to get this big mess. And then to get this thing, I've got to add these two messes together, and it simplifies. That middle part there cancels that middle part there. This part plus this part becomes just the r squared, because the cosine squared plus sine squared is 1. This part plus this part becomes that. And so this is the metric for R2 in polar coordinates. There it is in Cartesian. So the arc length is changing that fast if you're measuring things in Cartesian, that fast when you're moving to polar. By the way, that r squared d theta squared, you expect an r d theta. Why? Remember over here, if here's my point, the r is that length and the theta is that angle. Suppose I change that theta a little bit. How much do I change the point? I change it that much. But suppose I've got a big r, and that same little change in angle makes a much bigger change in the outcome. So you expect, when you change your theta, you expect to have an r involved telling you how much influence that change in theta has. Again, I'm just trying to get you used to the idea that, yeah, metrics are telling you true things, okay? In R3, there's the metric, it's spherical. Let's go to spherical, which is what we're going to need at the end. I remind you, spherical coordinates, ever so quick review of spherical. My x-axis, my y-axis, my z-axis. I take this point here. The r is the length of the line from the origin up to my point. In math books, it's called rho. In physics, it's called r. I like physics better for this. The phi, well, take the positive z-axis and look at the angle between the positive z-axis and that line. That's phi. And for the theta, well, drop a perpendicular from here down to the plane. There it is. And it's here. Take that line from the plane, and that angle is theta. Sometimes you see the phi and the theta interchanged. That will live with it. In any case, we're going to take it in this form. There's my equations. And you've seen this before in your calculus class. So as before, I used the product rule several times and the chain rule and all. Differentiate that, I get a big mess, I square it, I get an even bigger mess, I do the same here and here, and I add all those messes together, and they simplify to this. So this, when converted into this, becomes this. So there it is in Cartesian, there it is in spherical. Okay. If instead of, in that term, if I replace that coefficient of 1 with an r, you would look at that and you'd say, hey, that looks kind of like r3, except it's kind of bent somehow, because I don't have a 1 there. And then we're going to see happening at the very end. Okay. Oh, real quick exercise. What's the metric for the sphere of radius 1? Picture a sphere of radius 1 centered at the origin. Here's my origin. Picture a sphere of radius 1. What is its metric? Well, there is the full metric in spherical, but we're holding r fixed at 1. Our r is not changing. So the r is not changing, so its derivative is 0, which in metric notation means dr is 0. And those two r squares become 1. So this simplifies to this. And that is the metric for the sphere of radius 1. Now, suppose on this sphere of radius 1, I pick some angle like that one. I'm going to go in that direction. And I'm just going to change phi. So I'm going to be working. Remember, here's the x-axis, and phi equals 0 means that way, and phi 90 is that way, and phi 180 is that way. So I'm going to change the phi, which means I'm going to be going on that part of the great circle, okay? And let's just talk about what the metric is there. Well, what have I done? I've gotten this far so far, and now I say, well, furthermore, keep this angle fixed, and just let the phi change. So that d theta goes away, and I just get d tau squared equals d phi squared, so d tau equals d phi. So that seems to be saying the arc length is changing as fast as the angle is changing. Do we believe that? Yes. Here's a picture. This line is my x-axis. There's my phi. X radians. What does x radians mean? What are radians? We sometimes forget that. X radians means that if you're on a circle of radius 1, this arc length, that line there, has length x. That's the definition of x radians. So how fast is this distance going to be changing? How fast is this arc length going to be changing? Exactly as fast as this angle is changing. So that's what this is telling me. It's telling me the truth, once we remember what radians measure. And we always forget that. We always forget what make radians measure because we use them so often, we just use it without thinking about what it really means. So again, this is just a closing little tidbit here to convince us that metrics can be used to tell us about reality. Shall we break for pizza?
Sure.
Okay. That was a quick interview, introduction to metrics. We're going to come back to that for soapies. I could do it in 10 minutes. I'm going to take 40 minutes roughly. The reason being that there are some things that I think will help you comprehend. Someone I didn't learn on my first pass through, and I wish I had. Well, I learned more later, or I figured someone did this out myself, and after I did it, I said, oh yeah, now it begins to make more sense to me. Or I'm getting more comfortable with the weirdness. So, as I say, I could do this very quickly, I could do it in 10 minutes, but I don't think that's adequate. I think it leaves out important things, because it is so easy, it looks like trickery. Until you start thinking about some of these subtleties, then you realize it's not trickery, it's very deep. Even though it is very easy in mathematics, I have given this particular part of the talk to high school kids. They have no trouble with it. I mean, it's easy, but it's subtle. So I'm going to spend time on the subtleties. Special relativity talks about the following situation. You're in empty space, no stars around, no planets, no gravity. So if you give a baseball a little nudge, it'll coast off in the direction you nudged it at a constant speed. If it ever eventually comes near a planet or a star, the gravity will cause the path to curve. But that's disallowed in special relativity. So we're going to have three people. Okay, for simplicity's sake, I've got to draw pictures. I can only draw in two dimensions, not four. So I can't have x, y, z, comma, t. Dimensions. I'm going to have two. I'm going to have an x-axis and a y-axis. So all motion will be constrained to the x-axis. I'm going to have three people, A, B, and C, and they'll all be moving along the x-axis at a constant speed, just like that baseball you gave a nudge to. Either that way, the right, your right, my left, or that way, or maybe standing still. Also, I'm going to assume the speed of light is 1. What do I mean one? I mean 1 light year per year, or 1 light hour per hour, or 1 light second per second. Okay? All right. On that scale, by the way, normal everyday human speeds are tiny. For instance, 1,000 miles an hour is about 0.000005. So ordinary everyday speeds are tiny when we work on light going at speed 1. Now, suppose you've got three people I can see. And A is standing still at the point x equals 0. So here's x equals 0. A is standing still here. And B is moving that way at some constant speed. And C is moving that way. And the way I'm going to have it set up, A and B are going to, B is going to pass A at time 0 and then continue on her way. At time 0, C is going to be out here somewhere coming in this way. So So here's A, here's B, they pass at time zero, and then later on, C and B pass, and then later on, C and A pass. Okay? That's physically what's going on. But they're also all traveling through time. So here is a picture of that. This picture, kind of picture, is called a Minkowski diagram. So here I have my x-axis, or this is A's x-axis, and the time axis. And there's x equals 0, time equals 0, as the origin of our picture. And A is standing at x equals 0, standing still, but traveling through time. So no motion that way, all his motion is through time. So this line, which happens to be the t-axis, is A's path in time space. Now here's B. B's going that way. Now remember, motion that way is in time, motion that way is in space. So B is moving from the left to the right and passes A at time zero. Here is C, traveling through time that way, through space that way. So C is traveling from the right to the left, which is just the opposite of what I told you when I was pointing over here, but that's okay, you understand that. They're going, A and B are, you understand. Okay, so here's C going this way on the x-axis, but also through time, resulting in that path through space-time. This dotted line, that's light ray, a laser pulse if you want. Notice it is at 45 degrees, that's crucial. That's speed one. After all, that means 1 unit of time is 1 unit of distance. Again, 1 unit of time is 1 unit of distance. That length equals that length. That's telling me it's going at speed one. And it passes A and B just as they pass each other. Here's another light ray going the other direction, also at 45 degrees. 1 unit of time is 1 unit of distance. So light rays going 45 degrees. Vertical means no velocity. This is the fastest you can go in that direction. This is the fastest you can go in that direction. And other speeds are allowable, but I couldn't have something like that. That would go in faster than the speed of light. Oh, and how do I know that C is going that way and not that way? Well, that way has C going backward in time. So I certainly hope not. Okay, so that's how you read these Minkowski diagrams. Now, Einstein made two assumptions. I'm going to give them to you and talk about them. They're both strange. The first assumption is that everybody measures the speed of light as one. Why is that strange? Well, suppose I'm standing here, and you pass by me at 50 miles an hour, and a train, just as you pass me, a train zips by you and me, and compared to you, the train is going 100 miles an hour. So you're going 50 miles an hour faster than me because I'm just standing here, and the train is going 100 miles an hour faster than you. Well, how much faster than me is the train going? You would have no problem. That means, say, 150 miles an hour. Even though you couldn't conceive of going that fast. Fast as he would go is maybe 25 miles an hour. But, okay, so we said, yeah, 50 plus 100 gives 150. Newton says, ah, but suppose instead I'm standing here and you zip by at half the speed of light. So speed one half. Remember, the speed of light is one. And a light ray goes past you, and you measure its speed as one. So you're going speed one half compared to me, and the light ray is going speed one compared to you. How fast is the light ray going compared to me? Shouldn't it be one and a half? Einstein's first assumption is no. We will both measure that light ray as having speed one. That's strange. It doesn't go along with what we are used to, with railroad trains and things like that. Okay? It's a strange assumption. Why did he make this strange assumption? He had good reason to think it was true. First of all, Maxwell's equations implies that it's true. Actually, I don't remember Maxwell's equations, but I decided to sit down and really learn that. But they imply that it's true, apparently, and people knew that, and they said, well, let's do some experiments. We did experiments involving light coming from stars. So there's a star over there, and here's the Earth going around the sun, and sometimes the Earth is going towards the star, and sometimes it's going away from the star, and they measured the speed of light both in spring and in fall. And it didn't matter whether you're going towards the star or away from it. Both times you got the same speed for light. And since then, more and more precise experiments have been made, and it pans out. Everybody measured the speed of light as being one. Even two people passing each other are both going to measure the speed of light as one. That's a strange, weird fact, but it turns out to be the way the universe works. The second fact, I'm going to put this up here. There was my first assumption. Here's my second assumption that Einstein made. Every person, remember, we only have people moving at constant speed, has the right to say that they are standing still and everyone else is moving. Now, this doesn't seem so bad. After all, if I'm on an airplane going 500 miles an hour, and I glance out the window, it's a nice smooth ride, I glance out the window, I see clouds zipping by me. Even though in truth, the clouds are standing still and I'm zipping by them. But it's really easy to convince myself like that I'm still and they're zipping by me. Einstein said, go with that. You have the right to do it. In fact, do it. It's a good thing to do. Okay? That's different than acceleration. If the pilot steps on the gas, I can feel it. Or decelerates, I can feel it. Or goes around the corner, I can feel it. It's a little force. Okay? So constant speed is inherently different than accelerating. You can tell when you're accelerating or decelerating. Constant speed is a little iffy. Okay? Einstein said it should be iffy, because everybody has the right to say they're standing still and other people are moving. So we have constant speeds. So when I first read this, assumption one struck me as weird, and assumption two struck me as not so weird. Okay? Really happy with that? When I thought about it more, it occurred to me that assumption two is really weird. The first one's weird, and the second one is really weird. Assumption 2 is the real killer here. I'm standing still. B goes by me. Just as she goes by me, a firecracker goes off right there. Kaboom! She continues her way. I say, firecracker went off right there, right at my feet. Almost blew off my big toe. You can ask her if she was passing by. What does she say? Remember, she thinks she's standing still and I'm going that way. She says, firecracker went off right there, right at my foot. Almost blew off my big toe. You can ask him. He was passing by. So I ask you, where did the firecracker go off? You can grab a chair here if you would like. Did it go off here, or did it go off there? Einstein said, both people are right, from their own frame of reference, from their own viewpoint. Because you guys know where it really went off. You saw it go off right here, didn't you?
Yeah.
Except that was 2 minutes ago, and at that time, the surface of the Earth has spun. Remember, at the equator, you're going around at more than 1,000 miles an hour. We're going pretty fast. And the Earth is going around the Sun pretty fast. And the Sun is going around the center of the galaxy. I have no idea how fast, but my guess is it's pretty fast. And the galaxy is different from the universe. And the whole universe is expanding, these cosmologists tell us. So where did the firecracker go off? Pretty profound question. Newton believed in what was called absolute space. He believed that there was a universal coordinate system embedded in the universe, and everybody could measure their position with regard to this absolute coordinate system. Einstein said, no, Mr. Newton, it's all relative. Each person has their own coordinate system. And that is a profound difference between Newton's view and Einstein's view. So the first time I learned this, I thought assumption one is weird and assumption two is believable. No, the first one is weird and the second one is really, really, really weird. So let's look at our picture. We had this picture earlier. I'm now going to look at it from B's viewpoint. Here, A is standing still and B is moving that way. From B's point of view, B is standing still and A is moving the other way. And C is moving that way even faster. Faster because, remember, vertical is no speed. And a slope line is speed. And a more slope line is more speed. And the speed of light is the highest speed. Oh, there are two light beams. We had two light beams in the earlier picture. There they are again. And notice they are still at 45 degrees. That's important for what we're going to be doing. Because B measures the speed of light as 1. That's assumption 1 of Einstein. 1 unit of time is 1 unit of distance for this light ray. And the same for here. 1 unit of time is 1 unit of distance for the light rays. So both people agree on light rays. Light rays are 45 degrees in A's picture, and there are 45 degrees in B's picture. So the fact that both these pictures are true in A's viewpoint versus B's viewpoint are using Einstein's two assumptions. That B can think this, can think about that picture as being true is his second assumption, and the fact that her light rays are at 45 degrees, just like A's light rays were, is his first assumption. Now, the way I learned special relativity was using an approach due to a gentleman, a British physicist named Herman Bond, is a very nice way. So let's picture this. We have, here's our x-axis, and here's A. You're going to see this picture a lot. You know, A and B. A is standing still. We're going to look at things with A's viewpoint, almost always. A is standing still, just passing through time. And B is traveling that way, SBV. And just as they pass, they synchronize the clocks, so both clocks say time 0W. Now picture A, as he sits here at the origin, just passing through time, sending out a series of laser pulses. Right, the B's going that way, so he sends out laser pulses. Once every capital T seconds, or whatever the measure of time, once every capital T seconds. The very first one, he sends out at time 0. Well, at time 0, B is passing him. So he sets up this laser pulse, and it gets to B instantly, because she's right there. So on her clock, she gets it at time 0. But the second laser pulse, by the time he sends it out at time capital T, she's moved. And that second laser pulse has to catch up to her. So he sends it out at time T, but we don't expect her to get it at time T on her clock. After all, it took time for that laser beam to catch up to her. So she's going to get it at some other time, which we're going to call KT. And so if he's sending these out periodically, time 0, time T, time 2T, time 3T, she's going to be getting them periodically, time 0, KT, twice KT, 3 times KT. So gaps of size T here give gaps on A's clock, are going to give gaps, yeah, departure times of time T on A's clock are going to give arrival times of gaps KT on B's clock. Where we're talking about laser pulses. Those dotted lines are always going to be laser pulses. Okay? Let us find the value of A in terms of B speed V. Here's one of the subtleties I don't have to show you for what I need, but I think it's well worth showing you. Here's how Newton would have found it. You just look at that second laser, the first one down here. Here's the second one. Remember, both people have time 0 down here. Newton would have said, let's figure out B's position when she gets that second laser pulse. How far has she traveled? You know, what's her x position? How far has she traveled in space? He said, let's figure it out two ways and compare. Well, the first way, she was traveling at that speed for that much time. She started at time 0. She got it at time kt. So how far did she go? That's easy. Speed times time. So that's how far she went. That's her x position when she got that laser beam. Now let's figure out the laser beam's position when it reached there. Well, it's traveling at speed 1. How long did it travel? Well, it left at that time, it arrived at that time. The amount of time it traveled was this number, subtract that number. So it traveled that long at speed 1, so it got that far. The laser beam got that far, and she got that far, but they ended up in the same place. So this number must equal that number, and then you solve for V, and trust me, I did that correctly, you get that. So that's how Newton would have figured out a formula for K in terms of V. And Einstein would have said, no, Mr. Newton, there's a mistake in your reasoning. Very subtle mistake. Anybody see it off the top of their heads? If you haven't seen special relativity before, you have no hope, really, unless you're brilliant. If you have, maybe you've got a tiny hope. Newton made the mistake of thinking that time is passing for A's clock at the same rate that it's passing for B's clock, which allowed him to compare the time on B's clock to the time on A's clock and say, it left at this time and got at that time. But Einstein would say, yes, it left at that time on A's clock, but got there at that time on B's clock, and those are two different clocks. And the rate of time is going to be, the rate which time passes is going to be different for those two different clocks. So you can't do that. You can't compare her clock to his clock. That's a no-no, Mr. Just as Newton believed in absolute space, there was this universal coordinate system that everybody could refer to, he also believed in absolute time. It was a big granddaddy clock in the background. Everybody could glance at to see what time it is. Newton said, no, no, Einstein said, no, 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 Mr. Newton, everybody has their own clock. And different people's clocks will run at different times because time is flowing differently for different people, depending on how fast they're going. They've not seen special relativity before. This sounds truly weird, I know. But it turns out to be true. And notice, I'm not doing any hard mathematics here. So here's how Einstein would have answered the question. He would have used his two assumptions. He said, okay, here's the picture we had. The laser beam set up about time t on A's clock. Arrival time is kt on B's clock. Let's say that B replies. It bounces off the spaceship or whatever, or she says to reply, gets here. It's going to get there at that on A's clock. How come? Why, Einstein? Why is that going to be true? For the same reason that this t became a kt over here, this kt is going to become a k times kt over here. Because of this picture. Here's what B thinks. B thinks this guy is wrong. He thinks he's standing still and I'm moving away from him at speed V. The truth of the matter is I'm standing still and he's moving away from me at speed V. That's what's really going on. So if my interval of time is this number, if my emission time interval is that number, his arrival time interval is going to be K times that number. And that's where that K squared T came from. So, we're going to use A's clock, only A's clock. So no mixing of apples and oranges here. When did this bounce happen? Well, the speed of light is 1 going that way and 1 going that way, so it took as long to go out as it to come back. So the bounce happened halfway between these two numbers, which is the average of those two numbers. There it is. There's the average of those two numbers. That's when the bounce happened. So A says, B was traveling at speed V for that much time. And that's when my light beam hit her. So her position is going to be V times that average. On the other hand, how long did the light travel? Well, it traveled for half of that interval. That interval is k squared t subtract t, and half of it was going out and half of it was going back. So the amount of time it took going out was half of that difference, which is that. I multiply that by 1, and that's how far the light beam traveled. So I now equate these two numbers, and I solve for V. And trust me, I did it correctly, and I get that. And that is Einstein's formula.
Move it up a bit?
Yes. I surprised me the first time you needed to tell me. That is Einstein's formula for K in terms of V. Let's compare the two. Again, I don't have to do this. It's one of those subtleties. As I said, I could give this part of the talk in 10 minutes, but I'm going to take 40. Here's what Newton thought. Here's what Einstein thought. Let's rewrite that. I'm going to multiply it by 1. Ooh, that factor, that's 1. Hey, that just equals this. So they agree on the denominator. Newton thought the top was 1. Newton thought the numerator was 1. Einstein said, no, it's this. Now remember, for ordinary everyday speeds, like 1,000 miles an hour, for 1,000 miles an hour compared to the speed of light, the v turns out to be 0.000015, a very small number. And I swear it, it's minuscule. It's very small. Minuscule means small. So, for ordinary everyday speeds, this numerator and that numerator are so close together, you can't measure the difference really. He had. Poor Newton had no way of knowing that his mathematical model was wrong because it was so close to right that you couldn't tell it until you started getting to very, very high speeds. Okay? If the speed of light had been smaller, these effects would have become more obvious at low speeds. If the speed of light was 50 miles an hour, and you can travel 25 miles an hour on a horse, Newton probably would have discovered special relativity, or maybe Galileo, or maybe even Archimedes. All right. I want to just sort of dispense the page very quickly here. Remember we had me, you, and the train. You're going 50 miles an hour, the train's going 100 miles an hour faster than you, and he's going 150 miles an hour faster than me. On the other hand, of light. You're going half the speed of light. The speed of light, the light beam is going speed one compared to you. How come it's not going speed one half plus one compared to me, but it's still only going one? Why is that? How can those two facts kind of combine without jarring? I'm going to do this mostly as a homework problem for you guys. Look at this picture. B is traveling at speed V compared to A. C is traveling at speed B, B goes at speed V compared to A. C goes at speed U compared to B. And C goes at speed W compared to A. Find a formula for W in terms of U plus V. Well, Newton would have said it's that. Remember, the 50 miles an hour plus 100 miles an hour is 150 miles an hour. Einstein would have done it this way. He would have looked at this picture, and that picture would have told him this T becomes K sub VT, where that V means the K you get from V that we just talked about. And then to get from here to here, I got to then take this and multiply it by the K sub U, the same thing I get with a U there. But to get from here to here, I have to multiply this by the K sub W. So that equality tells me that this is true. And then I plug in the formulas for the various k's by this, and I do some high school algebra, and I get that formula. That's how you combine speeds. The combined speed is not v plus u, but it's v plus u divided by 1 plus v times u. So suppose v and u are small, ordinary, everyday speeds, 1,000 miles an hour or smaller. Then the V and the U are tiny, and the product is insignificant. And this is almost V plus U, so small you can't tell the difference. So Newton again had no way of knowing U is wrong. On the other hand, suppose the V and U are big. Suppose U is 1. V is some number, and U is 1. On the top, I get V plus 1. And on the bottom, I get 1 plus V. And W turns out to be 1. Any speed plus the speed of light, any speed combined with the speed of light gives the speed of light. So this is the correct formula, and it gradually merges this good but not entirely accurate formula into the accurate formula in such a way that we can't tell the difference for ordinary everyday low speeds. Now, we earlier saw this picture, and we're now getting into what I really wanted to talk about. The rest was stuff that I felt I would have liked to have learned the first time I saw this stuff, so I've added those things. But here's what we really want to talk about in this talk. We saw this picture. Suppose that was just not just a laser pulse, but it was a question. He's using his laser pulse to communicate a question with Morse code. And the question is, what time does your clock say at the instant that this message reaches you? And he sends that message out at time t on this clock. And she gets it at time kt on her clock. So she honestly replies, and that's her reply, my clock says time kt. And he gets it at that time on his clock. It's the same picture we saw before, except now we're thinking this is not just a laser pulse, but it's actually communication between A and B. He asks a question, she answers. She tells him what time her clock says. When does he think that happened? Or what does he calculate? It happened here. And this calculation is correct, because Einstein said he has every right to think he's standing still and she's moving. And the speed of light is 1. Okay? So his calculation is correct, based on Einstein's two weird assumptions. He's doing a correct calculation. And he's calculating, at that time on my clock, is when that bounce happened. And she told me her clock showed this number. And I trust her. She's a truth-telling woman. So when my clock said this time, her clock said that time. But when they both said time 0 down here, her clock is funny. It's running at the wrong rate. It's running slower than mine. My number is bigger than her number, it turns out. So let's figure out how much slower. Well, that means take the ratio of that number, or of that interval, if you will, to that interval. Divide that number by that number. Where is it? It's here somewhere. There it is. So the rate of B's clock compared to the rate of A's clock is kt divided by this thing. We simplify it to that. And I already know what k is. We just came up with a formula for it. I plug this into this and do some simple high school algebra, and it really is very simple high school algebra. Look at that. The ratio is that. So A measures B's clock as running slow by that factor. In A's point of view, B's clock really, and he knows it's true because she told him. She told him, my clock says time KT. And he said, huh, curious, my clock says that time. Your clock is running slow by that factor. He knows it's true. What does B think? Remember, she thinks she's standing still, he's moving. She does just the opposite. She says, his clock is running slow. A's clock is running slow by that factor. Doesn't matter if she's moving the other way. After all, minus V squared is the same as V squared. Or look at it another way. Moving away and moving towards each other get the same result. Because before she was moving, when she did them, she was moving towards him and moving away from him. So it doesn't really matter whether she was moving away or moving towards him. Not going to affect her clock because she's, In particular, suppose V is that number, square root of 3/4 the speed of light, then that factor, that fudge factor, turns out to be 1/2. So in this case, A measures B's clock as running half as fast as his, while B measures A's clock as running half as fast as hers. Who's correct? Both are. Einstein says, each person has their own clock. Time flows at different rates for different people. And you've got to accept it. And in each person's frame of reference, they are telling the truth. If this is your first time doing this stuff, it is very clear, but it turns out to be how the universe actually works. I want to, now again, I don't have to do this, but I've really explained to you time dilation in special relativity. I've fulfilled the advertisement. But I can't not tell you about the twin paradox. Because it is so famous, you learn the stuff, you learn the twin paradox, and I never really liked the explanation of it that I've seen. So I thought about it and came up with a better explanation. The other explanation was right, but not good enough. So again, we're going to have to speed so that our fudge factor turns out to be 1/2. That makes it easy to think about. We're going to have three people, A standing still, B going at speed, B away, going at that speed, away, and C going at the same speed towards. So here's A, and B is coming in this way, and C is at speed, B is going that way at speed, whichever way. B is going that way at speed V, and C is going that way at speed V. Okay? That's the picture, and here they are. And the A and B synchronize their watches just as they pass at time zero. And suppose it is set up that when B meets C, B's watch says time 2. And what she does is, as she passes C, she hands her watch over to C, and C brings it back. So the watch traveled outward with A, with B, and then came home with C. So here's A standing here. B goes out that way. Here C comes in this way. The watch gets handed off. So the watch started here, went out here, and came back. The way this is often given is with one or two people, and to make it dramatic, twins, identical twins. Okay. One stands still, the other takes a trip, and comes back, and they compare watches. And the two watches tell different times. Okay. That's why it's called the twin paradox, the twin. Now the paradox part. Let's get into that. So, the outward trip took 2 hours on the traveling clock. And the inward trip is going to take another 2 hours because it's got as far to come in as it did going out and it's coming in at the same speed that it went out. It took 2 hours going out. It's going to take another 2 hours coming in. So when it gets back to A, the traveling watch is going to say time 4. Time 0, time 2, time 4. Question, what time does A's clock say at that instant when C passes A? I'm going to give you two answers, and they're going to contradict each other. They're both going to look right, but they're going to contradict each other. And that contradiction is called the twin paradox. And then I'll talk about why one of them is wrong and what is wrong about it. So here's argument number one. Remember, A has measured that by measurement, has figured out that B's clock is running at half speed. And similarly, C's clock is running at half speed because the velocity here is the same, the speed here is the same as the speed here. On the other hand, B has measured that A's clock is running at half speed. And C also will measure that A's clock is running at half speed. So here's argument number one. A says, this clock was traveling at, was running at half speed and half speed. So the entire journey of that clock was running half as fast as mine. And this clock used up 4 hours. My clock will have used up 8 hours. The correct answer was 8. Second argument, B and C. They say, hey, our clock used up 4 hours. But throughout the whole time, A's clock was running half as fast as our clock. It will have used up 2 hours. There should be a 2 here. So those are the two arguments. They both seem pretty good. Yet they can't both be right. So which one is right and which one is wrong? Well, the first one had 8 here, which is more time. The first one said the stationary clock used up more time than the traveling clock. The second one said, had a 2 here, said the stationary clock used up less time than the traveling clock. So one definite way to resolve this is to do an experiment. And believe it or not, this experiment has been done. Nowadays, there are super accurate clocks using things like cesium, the vibrations of a cesium atom. I don't understand that, but they are ridiculously accurate, something like to within 1/1,000,000th of a second accuracy per century. But it took 2 of them, and they synchronized them. And they left one here, and they put the other on a jet plane, and they zoomed it across the country, and then they zoomed it back again, and they compared, and guess what? The traveling clock had used up less time than the stationary clock. That experiment has been done. So the first argument is correct, and the second argument is wrong. What's wrong with the second argument? Sure looked good. The explanation that I read, which is correct, said the second clock, the moving clock, broke the rules. It wasn't constant speed. It changed speed. But then you get into questions like, well, maybe when it changed directions, the jolt of changing directions screwed the clock up mechanism or something. It leads up to all kinds of things you're not comfortable with. Well, you could say, hey, the clock didn't pass hands, and just as they passed, B shot up to C. Set your clock at 2. So nothing physical passed, yeah? That makes it a little bit better. But here's what's really going on here. See, that argument that you've got a change of direction is the key to the error is correct, but it doesn't clarify it enough. So I want to try to clarify it better. What's really going on is the traveling clock experiences a change of viewpoint. Here's what it looked like. It looked like 2 hours got used up here, so A's clock should have used up 1 hour. Another 2 hours got used up here, so A's clock should have used up another hour. So 1 + 1 = 2, there should be a 2 here. That's what that second argument was. What it really should be is this. 1 + change of viewpoint + 1 = 8. And I will clarify that in a moment with another picture here. Here we go. I'm going to ask this question. Consider the incident that B meets C and their clock says time 2. What time does A's clock say at that instant when B meets C? What time is A's clock saying? Well, again, here's one of those things in special relativity you have to get used to. There is no absolute answer to that question. Different people have different answers. In fact, A, B, and C will all have their own answer to that question, and they'll all be right from their viewpoint. From A's viewpoint, the answer is obvious. Time 4. After all, everything here is time 0 for A, everything here is time 1 for A, everything here is time 4 for A. So hey, this happened at time 4. That's A's view. What about B? B says, hey, my clock took 2 hours, both in special relativity where you have questions that don't have absolute answers. In fact, let me give you one more quick one connected to that. Consider that event. B met C, and the clock said 2. And that event, A's clock said 4. Compare those two events. Which happened first? That question has no absolute answer. There are different answers for different people. people. A says they were simultaneous. They happened at the same time. B says this one and this one were simultaneous. When my clock said two, A's clock said time one, and that was later. So this one was first and that one was later. C says this and that were simultaneous events, and this one was earlier. So this one was first and that one was later. So the very concept of time ordering of events is in some situations, not all situations, but in many situations, no longer absolute. You've got to throw that idea out when you're talking about special relativity. And that is the second part of the talk. Shall we take another short pizza break? I should have mentioned, let me mention it, I forget what it was. Back here in this picture, everybody is right. A really does have B's clock running at half speed. And B really does have A's clock running at half speed. And C really does have A's clock running at half speed. So everybody was right. Everybody was right. And it wasn't 1 plus 1 equals 2. It was 1 plus change of viewpoint plus 1 equals 8. And that gap between 1 and 7 represents the change of viewpoint. So that is a better explanation of the twin paradox than I had seen when I read about it. So I wanted to pass it on to you. Okay. So one more thing in special relativity that we need to move on to general. Here's an easy picture. B makes a journey, traveling outward at speed V, leaving at this time on A's clock and coming back and ending, starting at that time and ending at that time. So on A's clock, the interval of time, the amount of time used up on the journey was that number. Can A figure out how much time was used up on B's clock for her journey? Well, of course, because A has already done measurements and knows that B's clock is running slow by that factor. So if his clock used up that much time, her clock would have used up that much time. So that much time passed on her clock during her journey. And that's called the proper time. It's the time told by the clock that is actually doing the journey. The proper time. All right. Suppose it's more interesting. Suppose this is B's journey, the curved path. So she's moving away from A, then turns around and comes back towards A, and then moving away towards A, and coming back towards A, also while moving. Done. So what that is here's A and here's B. She moves away and then comes back and then moves away and then starts to come back. How much time is used up on her clock? What's her proper time for that journey? Well, A can approximate it by saying, I'm going to approximate that much of her journey by that path, by that straight line, and that much by that straight line, and that much by that straight line. And I know how to find the answer for straight lines. So in that straight line path, I use that much time, and I multiply it by the fudge factor, that. And so this tells me how much time she would have used up had she done that. And the second term,
can you move it up a bit?
There. That term, that much time, multiplied by that fudge factor coming from that speed, tells me how much time that journey, that part of the journey would have used, and this gives how much time that would have used. And that's an approximation to her actual journey. Not a very good approximation. To get a better approximation, do the same thing, but instead of three pieces, let's use five. Okay, here's the picture. One, two, three, four, five. Okay. And doing the similar thing as before. For instance, in this interval of time, there's a real path. We're going to approximate it by that. And so the approximate amount of time used up on her clock during this interval of time is that multiplied by that fudge factor. And I do that for all five pieces, and I add them together, and I get that as an approximation to the amount of time that B used up on her journey. And there it is in a sigma notation. And then, to get a better approximation still, instead of taking five pieces, take 10, then take 100, then 1,000, then 10,000, da da da. Each time you get a better approximation, and then take a limit. And that's going to be the proper time. Now, who can tell me a quick way of getting that answer? Please, somebody tell me how quick way. What? You don't want to see a professor emeritus cry. Oh, well.
Integrate 1 minus b squared.
What's that?
Integrate square root of 1 minus b squared.
Oh, integrate. Okay, you guys have taken calculus. Remember, integration is used for a lot more than finding areas under curves. Okay? And areas under curves is the least interesting and least important application of it. This kind of thing is where the power of integration really shows up. Okay? That's exactly, you know, in integration, what are you really doing? You're taking better and better approximations and taking their limit. And the fundamental theorem of calculus essentially says there's a quick way of doing that. Okay? And the quick way is, you know, just, you know how to do integration. So there is her proper time. It's given by that integral. I'm going to call that tau. Earlier, I used tau to represent arc length. Now I'm using it to represent proper time. So earlier, when we were just talking about space, but not space-time, the tau would have represented the length of her curved path, its arc length. But now, since we're in space-time, tau is going to represent the time used up on her clock during that journey, her proper time, the journey. Okay? All right. So there we are again. Now, from this, what we just had, as before, the derivative of tau will be the integrand, which is that. Okay. And squaring I get this. But v, that's the speed. That's her speed. And speed is the derivative of position. It's how fast is your position changing. And the x is giving her position. So the v of t is just x prime of t, the derivative of x with respect to t. So this becomes this. I'm not going to rewrite that in the other notation for derivatives. There is the other notation for derivatives. And now I'm going to formally multiply by t squared to get that pattern. And I call that the metric for flat spacetime. That is the metric for flat spacetime, where the tau now represents proper speed instead of arc length. And we're going to think of it as being a reminder of the fact that the rate of change of proper time. In other words, how fast is B's clock moving? How fast is B's clock changing compared to our clock? How fast is B's clock changing compared to, this is dt. That's the tau is B's clock, the t is A's clock. So how fast is B's clock changing compared to how fast A's clock is changing? So there's the metric for flat space-time. Suppose B, instead of being a person, is a light beam or a laser pulse. Then B of T is 1. And we already had this. We had this equation from the previous page. So if it's a light beam, we're talking about a laser pulse, then the V becomes 1, and I get 0. Hey, light does not experience the passage of time. The light beam's clock never changes. Its derivative is 0. Light does not experience the passage of time. Photons never get old. Ever seen a photon with gray hair? That is worth thinking about, my friends. Okay. We're going to use that at the end. That since it's always that tau prime is 0, we're going to use it in the metric form dt is 0. If for a light beam, not for other things, but for light. Let's go to full space-time. Instead of just xt, instead of one dimension for space, we're going to have all three, as well as time. So in one dimension, speed was given by that, which is, x prime, the square root of x prime squared. In full space-time, speed is given by that. You know that from calculus, that's the speed. So the metric for full, flat space-time, x, y, z, comma t, space-time, is that. We're going to use it in spherical. We've already talked about that. So there it is in spherical. And remember, when we just had space and this represented arc length, that was the metric for R3. That was the metric for R3, for flat R3 in spherical. And this looks very similar, except this part is negated and that detail there is a positive. Okay? All right. We'll come back to that in a little bit here. Now, in the curve space time. You'll often hear it said that Einstein said gravity warps space. That is not correct, really. He didn't say gravity, he said mass. And he didn't say space, he said space-time. So gravity, so mass warps space-time. And that warping leads to effects that we call gravity. So he said, gravity is an illusion created by the warping of space-time, the warping being caused by the presence of mass. And then he spent about 10 years trying to figure out a mathematical description of how mass bends space-time. It was really hard work. Even for Einstein, he had to learn a whole bunch of mathematics, and he had some new mathematics, and he had to learn tensor analysis and all, which is, very messy stuff. But in the end, he came up with a set of, I believe it was 10 very complicated differential equations, which together describe how mass bends space-time. They're so complicated that it's essentially impossible to come up with a complete solution. So what people did instead is they studied it in easy cases. They said, let's look at this easy case and see if we can at least solve these in this easy case. Well, like in physics problems, you say, ignore air friction just to make it easier. So people at the beginning said, let's make the problem as simple as possible. And then as they got more comfortable with it and they got experience, they started are now studying more and more complicated things. But we're going to look at one of the very earliest ones, Schwarzschild space-time. So here's what Mr. Schwarzschild considered. He says, suppose we have empty space. I'll show that in a moment. We have empty space. And except for a big mass, a spherical mass of mass capital M, maybe like the sun, picture the sun. Maybe there's a couple of observers, A and B, but otherwise empty except for the sun. And we're going to work in spherical coordinates, and R is going to measure the distance from the position of the sun outward, whichever way you're going outward. So R equals 0 means you're at the center of the sun. And this thing is not spinning. It turns out that spinning makes it harder, and it's also more realistic. In reality, things spin, even black holes, I'm told. But to make it easy, it's not spinning. And it's symmetric, because it's a nice sphere, and it is unchanging with time. It's static. Okay? So easiest possible case. He said, can I figure out how that would bend space-time? Can I make Einstein's formulas happy in that? Can I figure out how to make them happy in all 10 of these differential equations? And because he had all this nice stuff, the 10 collapsed into only 3 or a few of them, because there were repetitions once, because if it's spherical and stuff like that. So he had a much easier problem. And he came up with a solution. He figured out how space-time would bend. So how could he explain it? Well, he gave the metric for it. That's how he explained how it bent. And I will show you the metric that he came up with. There it is. Now, that looks very similar to the flat space-time. That has a gamma there and a gamma inverse. In flat space-time, those are both 1. So if I put 1s there instead of the gamma and gamma inverse, I would have exactly flat space-time. But now I've got to tell you what this gamma is. Before I do that, I have to show you a way of taking the mass m, this capital M, of our sun, and converting it to another number, little m. And that's going to be my conversion. Here we're going to be measuring mass in kilograms. C is the speed of light, so it's measured in meters per second. And G is the universal gravitational constant. I remind you, here is Newton's famous law of gravity. It says if you've got two masses, M1 and M2, separated by a distance d, then the force of gravity between them is given by this number g times M1 times M2 divided by d squared. That's Newton's law of gravity. We'll take that same g and use it over here. G, the units of it are meters cubed divided by kilograms times seconds squared. And the number itself is something like 6.7 times 10 to the minus 11. Very tiny number. In any case, I use that to convert my mass, capital M, into this little number n. And it turns out the units, when you plug in these units and these units and these units, the units for little n is meters. What we've done is we converted a mass into a distance by this conversion process. And then I want my gamma that I need for the Schwarzschild metric. be that number. 1 subtract twice this, that n divided by r. R being the distance you are out from the center of the sun. In our cases, r is always going to be bigger than 2m, so this gamma is going to be between 0 and 1. By the way, for the sun, in kilometers, 2m, when converted to kilometers, turns out to be about 2.9 kilometers, but the radius of the sun is about 7 times 10 to the 5th kilometers. In other words, the sun is this huge sphere. Picture inside of it, right in the center, a small sphere of 2.9 kilometers. Also here, there inside the sun. We can't get that way because the sun's in the way. So we're going to begin by hovering near the surface of the sun, but not get too close to that because we can't get through up. So, first of all, though, let us suppose R is big. Here was the Schwarzschild metric, and there was the gamma that we're using there and there. Suppose R is very big compared to this 2m. So we're far, far, far from the surface of the sun. Then 2m over r is a small number. And the 1 minus 2m is almost 1. And so gamma inverse is also almost 1. So if we're far, far, far from the surface of the sun, far away from the sun, that gamma and that gamma inverse both become almost 1, and this is almost this. And this was the metric for flat space-time, telling us far from the sun, there ain't going to be much bending going on, which we know also is going to mean there's not much effective gravity far from the sun. Schwarzschild had certain clues to what his metric should look like, and that was one of them. He knew that far from the sun, it should look flat. He had other clues, like he knew there wasn't going to be a d phi times d theta term. If there was a d phi times a d theta term, a non-zero d phi times d theta term, it would matter whether you changed theta in a positive way or a negative way. That would change the sign. But we got symmetric. It shouldn't matter. So he knew there wasn't going to be any d theta times d phi term. So he had various hints. But he still had to work hard and come up with his method. Now, suppose we're going to do two applications of it. One easy one and then one slightly harder one. Suppose you're far away. You're way up there. And the little t is going to be time on your clock, because you're up there in flat space-time, or almost flat space-time. Your friend comes in, let's get a better look, comes in closer to the surface of the sun and hovers there. So you're hovering way out there, your friend is hovering closer in. I'm not going to do metrics, kind of like I did when I talked about metrics earlier, played with them, just play with this. What is your friend's journey through space-time? Well, he's hovering. So his position in space is not changing. His R is not changing. His theta is not changing. His phi is not changing. Only he's only passing through time. So what does that tell us about the metric? For the metric, the R is not changing. So its derivative is zero. So this dr becomes zero. And the d phi is not changing. So d phi is zero. And the d theta is zero. It's not changing. So this full metric simplifies to this. And I get just that. So I divide through by the dt squared, and I take square roots, and I get this. So tau prime is that, which is that. What that tells us, and remember that t is your clock, and the tau is, the dt is the rate of change of time on your clock, which is of course 1 second per second. The d tau is the rate of change on your friend's clock. And your friend's clock is running slower than your clock by that factor. That's what the metric is telling us. Do we believe that? By the way, your friend is unaware of it. Your friend can't tell. He thinks, my clock's running fine. You know, I ate breakfast, 5 hours ago. I'm hungry. That's all. Time is going perfectly normal. There's only when he goes back and compares to your clock, he says, hey, something's changing. Do we believe that? Well, remember super accurate clocks? This experiment has been done. At least I've read it's been done. One of them was left at the bottom of the tower, the other was put at the top of the tower, and they waited a year or a long time. And then they put them together again and compared. And guess what? Less time had passed on the clock near the surface of the Earth than on the clock at the top of the tower. In fact, the amount of difference was what was predicted by this theory. That's one application. Now, noted for our sun, huge radius, and there's this imaginary sphere of radius 2.9 right at the center of the sun. We can't get close to it. But suppose I could squeeze the sun and compact all of its mass inside that little imaginary sphere. If I could do that, what I would have accomplished is to turn the sun into a black hole. And this imaginary sphere would become its event horizon. So I want to finish by talking about what happens if you approach the event horizon. So you're here and your friend comes down and loses control and starts falling in toward the event horizon. Let's look at that. Well, it turns out the mathematics is easier if I replace your friend with a light beam. So instead we're going to have you shoot down a light beam. And I'll show you why the math is easier. You shoot down a light beam, a laser beam, a laser pulse towards the origin. And let's look at what happens to it from your point of view. For that laser pulse that's coming down, its radius is changing, but it's going in a straight line right toward the origin, meaning that its two angles, the theta and phi, are not changing. They're both constant, so the derivatives are zero, so their d theta and d phi are both zero. So I take my metric, the short shield metric, and the d phi becomes zero, the d theta becomes zero, and my metric becomes just that. Think of this. Okay? Now I'll remind you, we have a light beam here, and light never gets older. Its clock never changes, telling me that d tau is zero if I got a light beam. So I can make the d tau be zero. I couldn't do that for your friend, because your friend is not a light beam. So that will make the math harder, which is why I'm doing it for a light beam. So that becomes a zero. And I get this. Zero equals that, which tells me this. And then from this, I get this, divided through by dt squared, and taking square roots, I get that, with a plus or minus gallon. Let's see here. This light beam is coming inward, so its r is constantly getting smaller. So I want the derivative, dr dt, to be negative. So I take the minus gamma. So r prime, which is that, is minus gamma. But minus gamma is that number, which I rewrite that way. So here I have a differential equation. Remember, what is r of t? It tells me at what radius, how far out is the light beam, how far out from the center of the sun is the light beam at time t on your clock. And you're way up there. And I have a differential equation. R prime, look at that. Turns out, that's very hard to solve. So I'm now going to show you a page of niceties, not hard, but nice mathematical trickery that will allow us to make progress. The r is always getting smaller. I've got a monotonically decreasing function. It's got an inverse. Let's call the inverse g. So there's a function g with the property that r of g of x equals x. Some of you have seen done in calculus. I'm going to differentiate both sides with respect to x. The derivative of that is 1. The derivative of that turns out to be that. So I have this equation, and you see this trick in calculus. I'm going to solve for that, and I get this. I'm now going to work on that denominator, the bottom there. Remember, we already had this differential equation from the previous page. For t, I'm going to plug in g of x. And so when I do that, I get this becomes this. But I remind you, the r of g of x is just x. So this becomes this. So this can get plugged into that denominator there. I take, there was that, this equation is this equation here. I plug this into that denominator, get this. I simplify it this. And I got another differential equation. G prime is given by that. But that was easy to solve. The first one was hard to solve. This was easy to solve. It's just an integration problem. G of x is the integral of that. It's the integral of that. And that's an easy, easy, easy integral. You've done that kind of integral in calculus. It's just a simple-minded u substitution. Use that substitution. And the answer you end up getting is that g of x is that. Or that c is the famous plus c, the constant of integration you always have to add. Okay? It turns out it depends on how far away you are. So I can now graph g of x. And here's a graph of what I just shown me. There's the graph of g of x. And it turns out here's 2m. And as x approaches 2m, as you get closer and closer and closer and closer to 2m, it asymptotically does that, goes up to infinity. And somewhere here it crosses the x-axis, and exactly where depends on what c is. By the way, this g, this x represents some radius. I picked some radius, x. And I'm asking the question, at what time on your clock does this light beam reach that position x? The answer is g of x. That's what the g of x is telling me. It's telling me when on your clock did my light beam get to there. That's what that g of x really is. It's the t, that the light, the time that the light beam reaches position x. So g of t is, now r of t is r of g of x, which is x. The radius at time t is x. Okay. This is the inverse of r. I want r. So I know how to, you know, given this, I know how to draw the inverse. I interchange those two axes, and here's my picture of r. And that 2n becomes this. And we're across the other one across the x-axis. This one's going to cross this axis, because the x-axis really is the r of t axis. So what's this telling me? This is telling me from your, this is a graph of the position of the light beam, the radius of the light beam, how far it is from zero. Here's zero, the center of the sun, at time t on your clock. And look what's happening. It's getting closer and 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 closer, but never quite gets there. Your friend falling in would do a similar thing at a slower rate. From his own point of view, he would quickly pass through the event horizon and get sucked into the... Well, actually, you don't know for certain what happens after you pass the event horizon, but okay. But from your point of view, you can watch him fall into his death for the whole rest of your life. And there is a very devastatingly heart-wrenching short story called Kyrie by Paul Anderson based on that premise, okay, which I read when I was about your age, and it made me decide, someday I want to understand this stuff. And about 10 years ago, I made that promise come true. And I've just shown you the outcome. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Do we have any questions?
Line here is a line of simultaneity for A. Everything on this line happened at time 1 from A's point of view. Everything on this line, that horizontal line, at time 0 to me. Everything on that horizontal line happened at time 1. Everything on that horizontal line happened at time 4. But B's lines of simultaneity will be different. Remember, we saw when in B's point of view, when her clock said 2, A's clock said 1. So this event and that event were simultaneous. Well, connect those two points with a straight line, and that will be a line of simultaneity for B. She will say everything on that line happened at time 2. And for C, well, connect that point to that point, the 7 up there, and that will be a line of simultaneity for C. Well, I think what they're saying is if you've got a spinning black hole, lines of simultaneity will end up being wrapped around the thing as you get closer and closer and closer, is what I'm guessing that phrase means, what I've read in the popular press. Knowing what little I know, that is my best guess. The physics course, department does give courses in you know, general relativity. In fact, I'm told that next semester, Professor Matt Stern is going to give both an undergraduate and graduate course in them. You can research it if you want to learn more about it. Other questions? Oh, good. Thank you very much for your attention.